Today at Reader's Corner, Scott Galloway, author of The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Chances are that today, like every day, you'll interact with one or more of four gigantic companies that have become embedded in daily life. Need to buy a book? It's just a quick click away on Amazon. Curious about the person who wrote it? Google the author on your iPhone. You can follow her on Facebook, too. And that's just the veritable tip of the iceberg when it comes to the services these companies provide. They can make our lives easier, but at what cost? In his book, The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, Scott Galloway challenges us to think more deeply about the profound impact these companies have on our personal lives and on business in America and around the world. He is a professor at New York University's Stern School of Business, where he teaches brand strategy and digital marketing to second-year MBA students. A serial entrepreneur, he has founded 9 firms. Professor Galloway was elected to the World Economic Forum's Global Leaders of Tomorrow, which recognizes 100 individuals under the age of 40 whose accomplishments have had an impact on a global level. And in 2012, he was named one of the world's 50 best business school professors by Poets and Quants. His weekly YouTube series, Winners and Losers, has generated tens of millions of views. Mr. Galloway joins us today by Skype to talk about his first book. Scott Galloway, welcome to Reader's Corner.
No, thanks for having me.
Well, Scott, I have to tell you right off the bat, I'm all in, or almost all in, when it comes to the subtitle of your book. I have everything Apple's just put out. I have the latest Kindle, the whole nine yards. As far as Amazon, my gosh, I must be one of their prime subscribers simply because I buy a heck of a lot of books online. Also frequent the independent bookstores, of course, like I always urge our listeners to do. But who am I kidding? I'm one of those guys keeping these companies going. I guess my first question is that this book, as I finished it, I realized, hey, this is a cautionary tale, to say the least. Can you summarize for us what the greatest concerns are when it comes to these four gigantic companies?
It's a truism of history, and that is power corrupts. And that is, these companies are doing their job. They're using their incredible influence and power to create monopoly-like control of their respective sectors. And I think it's bad for the economy. It's difficult to get a company funded now, harder for startups. A lot of big companies that have traditionally been great employers are being euthanized prematurely. So in sum, power corrupts. These companies are too powerful, and it's having a negative impact on employment, middle-class wages, and the innovation economy.
And how they got there is part of the issue as well. You talk about the sins of the four horsemen. Tell us a little bit about what the sins are. I think you highlighted a couple in one of your chapters.
I mean, you sort of have the perfect storm here. You have a society that no longer worships at the altar of character and kindness, but innovators and billionaires. And so we don't subject these companies to the same scrutiny we subject other companies. Facebook has acquired 67 companies, Amazon 94, and Google 221, and none of them have come under any real antitrust review. And as a result, we now have Facebook control 6 of the top 10 apps globally. 80% of your time on your phone is in apps. So effectively, mobile phones are now just a delivery vehicle for Facebook Inc. You have Apple has effectively been able to kind of corner the market on devices from a profitability standpoint. Google has 93% share of the search market, which by dollar volume is greater than the entire ad market of any nation. The big lie there was information wants to be free, and they convinced a bunch of old economy companies and newspapers to give them their content for free. So there's been, you know, there's been a couple of what I would call sort of monster mistakes from old media. And I think our society, in terms of deciding that billionaires and innovators are the new Jesus Christs of our society. And when, again, we just don't hold them to the same standards we hold every other company.
What are these companies, how do they relate to one another, one to the other?
Oh, they hate each other. I mean, they all think they're the rightful heir to the throne. So they all see themselves as the one true king. They've mostly been able to play in their own, you know, their own swim lanes, so their own sandbox, whether it's computer hardware, search, social, or retail. These companies kind of have their own swim lanes, but they've increasingly been bumping up against each other. What these companies are at the end of the day is operating systems for different parts of your life. Amazon's operating system for retail, Facebook's operating system for your relationships, Apple for media and content, and then Google's kind of the operating system for information. But each of them would like to be the operating system for your just entire digital life, that the interface to everything through the digital portal would be their portal. And they're all trying to elbow each other out, infringing on each other's territory. So there's some safety and hatred, and that is they do compete against one another. But for the most part, they're monopolies in their respective sectors, and any little company, you know, kind of the best a small company can hope for right now is to be acquired. It's very difficult to edge in on their territory.
So let's start with Amazon. That's where your subtitle takes us first, alphabetically. Amazon, how did it get its start? How big is what's known as Earth's biggest store?
I mean, this is one of the great stories in business history, and started out obviously just selling books. Company founded in the 90s, and probably the seminal moment in the history of Amazon was the famous investor letter in 1997 that Bezos penned to his investors saying there are three truisms or non-perishable attributes of consumer value, selection, and convenience. And we're going to invest massively across those three things, regardless of the short-term vagaries of the marketplace. And they have stayed true to that. And people forget that there were periods in Amazon's history where the markets really took the stock down, and they never stopped investing. They never stopped playing for the long game. And it's been this story that is just the most romantic, seductive story in the history of business that's resulted in the lowest cost of capital. So Amazon has been able to grow 30-40% a year for 20 years and break even, operate at break even. Meanwhile, it's about to become the most valuable company in the world without ever having achieved any meaningful profits. So regardless of their management, regardless of how innovative they are, regardless of the economic environment, Amazon will win. And the reason they'll win is that if Amazon is afforded the luxury of the marketplace, specifically investment markets, where they can reinvest 100 cents on the dollar back into the consumer experience, and every other company gets to reinvest somewhere between 60 and 90 cents on the dollar, then ultimately Amazon will win just because they have more gas in the tank. So Amazon, if I were going to write a follow-up to the four, it would be called the one. Wherever Amazon is bumping up against any of the other three, wherever Amazon is kind of bumping up against another competitor, almost always Amazon is winning.
And along the way, Amazon hasn't exactly wanted to play by the rules, certain government rules like taxation and how it treats its employees for that matter.
Well, I would argue they have played by the rules. It's just that the rules haven't caught up to modern day economy. So Amazon, since 2008, has paid $1.4 billion in corporate income tax. Walmart has paid $64 billion. This despite the fact that in 2017, there was a three-month period where Amazon added the entire value of Walmart to its market capitalization. So just as public policy hasn't caught up to the fact that we're living into our 80s and now an enormous population feels entitled to Social Security and we end up with a budget where two-thirds goes to entitlement, kind of crowding out investment and ability to do other things, we never contemplated a marketplace where the most successful company in the world wouldn't be profitable. As a result, Amazon really pays no corporate income tax. And what does that mean when the most successful company in the world doesn't pay corporate income tax? It means less successful companies have to pay more. So we've institutionalized a regressive corporate taxation structure, which isn't, most people would say, is probably not a good thing. That just creates this runaway lottery effect where one company just sort of runs away with it. Well, if taxation is based on profitability and investors don't demand we're profitable, let's just never be profitable. And then we can reinvest all of our proceeds and basically exhaust every other competitor. We're going underwater with the largest tank of oxygen, which is capital, and eventually everybody else drowns.
There's one thing about your analysis of Amazon that really caught my eye. I had Martin Ford on here a couple of years ago, at least, about a book he wrote called The Rise of the Robots when he first raised the question, at least in my mind, about the guaranteed national income. And then I started hearing more and more from Silicon Valley about the guaranteed national income. And, of course, it comes up in your book because you point out the fact that Amazon, a couple of years ago or so, bought a company called Kiva Systems, which is all about warehouse robotics, which leads one to wonder how many more people or how many fewer people Amazon will really have to employ. And we have huge numbers of people, as Martin Ford in his book predicts, by the middle of this century, they're going to be out of work. We can't even pay for decent Medicaid systems right now. How in the heck are we going to pay for millions of people that are on the streets because there's no place to go for work?
It's a really big issue. The notion that we might have a future that doesn't involve work. And I spoke right after Jeff Bezos at a conference hosted by JP Morgan 2 years ago in Miami. And he suggested during his speech that we should be seriously considered a universal guaranteed income. And I think the initial response from the crowd was, wow, what a generous guy and what a thoughtful progressive guy. And I found it really frightening that probably the individual with the most insight into the future of business doesn't see a future of work. And for me, it's more personal than anything because my identity largely stems from two things, my success or lack thereof as a head of household and a dad, and then two, work. I get a big part of my identity from work. So not being able to or even allowed not to work for me would just be emasculating. And I think it goes even deeper than that, that our national identity as Americans is that we're risk takers, we're innovators, we're a generous people. And we're, you know, core to the central identity or DNA of America is that we work. So when the wealthiest man in the world, the most visionary person in the world, arguably the most influential business person on the planet, is kind of thrown up his arms and said, whatever the future involves, it involves welfare for people who used to work and now don't have jobs. I find that frightening. And I would hope that people with the influence and CEOs like Mr. Bezos have more of a vision around building industries and investing in places where there's more jobs. There's actually more job listings right now than there are people looking for jobs. We just don't seem to be training these people for those jobs. So this is a problem we can fix. Our future involves work, it involves being proud of your work, it involves economic security. So, you know, I would hope these guys envision a future of work, not of universal guaranteed income.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and my guest is Scott Galloway, author of The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. And the impact that Amazon has had on retail is enormous, especially, I believe at some point you quote how many people in 1 year would be thrown out of work. 76,000 retail jobs this year could be lost. You could fill up an NFL stadium, you say.
Yeah, it's likely a lot more than that. I mean, even just I'm on the board of a retail company. I've been on the board of others. And every retail company, anytime Amazon does anything, everyone takes it very seriously and immediately begins chasing the ball that Amazon has talked about or has thrown, if you will. And Amazon recently, with their Amazon Go store, got rid of the cashiers, used artificial intelligence to basically do away with the cashiers. And so now in a lot of retail boardrooms, they're talking about store optimization, which is Latin for fire cashiers or salespeople. And there are 11 million cashiers in the United States. There's more cashiers than there are teachers in the United States. So I think when Amazon Go store opened, just one store, I think arguably somewhere between 1 and 3 million cashiers lost their jobs. Now, you can't protect jobs. You can protect people, but you can't protect jobs. And if cashiers are meant to go away, they're meant to go away. But you're seeing at the hands of Ford because they are just so incredibly efficient and enormous job destruction, probably even more so than Amazon, because Amazon is actually hiring a lot of people on the back end of fulfillment. Amazon has about 500,000 employees. Facebook and Google will probably put between 150 and 200,000 media professionals out of business every year for the next 5 years. So take four Yankee stadiums, fill them with copywriters, agency planners, creative directors, and say, congratulations, you're out of work, courtesy of Facebook and Google. I mean, there's incredible job destruction here. But again, I'm not sure you can stop that. I'm not sure you should stop it. But at a minimum, these companies should pay their fair share of taxes. At a minimum, they should be subject to the same anti-competitive reviews that every other company is subject to. I mean, we're talking about restraining AT&T's acquisition of Time Warner, 130 million phone contracts, and then some great content from Time Warner. But yet we let Amazon have 62% penetration of U.S. households with Amazon Prime Video. That's their distribution. They're in two-thirds of all U.S. households. No cable company has that. And they're the second largest spender on original content at $5.5 billion. Yet we think AT&T needs to sell the Cartoon Network. There's just two ecosystems here. One ecosystem is where business has to compete. And then there's another ecosystem, and that's where tech, big tech, gets to compete. And it's two different worlds. So if they're going to be job destroyers, if they're going to be innovators, if they're going to be the most successful companies in the world, great, more power to them. But we can't take the best team in the league and let them have 12 players on the field. And that's what we're doing right now.
Let's talk about Apple for a minute. We'll never get through all four of these in 30 minutes, but that's why people buy books, and I strongly recommend The Four by Scott Galloway. And we're talking to Scott here. So let's move along with Apple. I visited last fall the cathedral in Cupertino, not the new cathedral, but the old cathedral. The old cathedral is quite a cathedral itself. It's dedicated to Steve Jobs. You might say he's at the altar still hanging from the cross. And it reminds me of something you say in your book. Well, you don't say it this way, but in a way, Apple is better off with Steve Jobs dead than who knows what would have been like if he was still alive. Your thoughts?
So, yeah. So first off, you know, a tragedy, anyone who dies that young. So I don't want to in any way suggest it's a good thing. But
right.
If you just look at it from a shareholder perspective, you know, there's two things that drive iconic, timeless brands. If you think of people as brands, the first is excellence or charity or leadership, but just I'll just generally call it excellence. The next thing is for them to die early, because then we don't have to watch them get fat and eat ice cream. We don't have to watch old Elvis. We watch young Elvis. So when people have an early demise, it sort of cements their iconic status, whether it's Marilyn Monroe or JFK or Steve Jobs. And when Steve Jobs was taken early, it sort of cemented his status, in my view. As cultures become more educated, more affluent, they're less reliant on a super being. Church attendance goes down. But our questions and needs for answers and leadership and spiritual guides only becomes greater. And I think the new religion in the U.S. is what I'll call innovation. And the church that everyone's most excited about is Apple. And the Jesus Christ of that church is Steve Jobs. Now, you know, Steve Jobs, an incredible business person. People talk about him denting the universe. I don't believe he dented the universe. I think he's an incredible business person, an incredible visionary. But he's also an individual who denied his blood, who denied that he was the father of a little girl when he knew he was the father under oath so he could avoid child support payments at a time when he was worth $250 million. So, you know, I say in the book that, look, innovation and our idolatry of billionaires and innovators and Steve Jobs is, in my opinion, kind of perverted a fairly basic truth, and that the fastest blue line path to a better world is more engaged fathers and more engaged parents, not a better phone. So I think Steve Jobs is a perfect example of how we've gone overboard in terms of our idolatry of young people and billionaires and innovators.
Well, let's talk about the company and the terrorism investigation, the role of the FBI, and most importantly, what Apple decided to do.
Well, that's a great example. So terrorists kill 17 people in San Bernardino, and the FBI gets a court order to get into the phone and says, look, we would like to see if there's any other acts of terror unfolding as we speak, so we'd like to get into this individual's phone. And Apple basically waves a middle finger in the face of the court order and the FBI and says, we're going to take a stand for privacy. And what's interesting is that the majority of Americans support it. And if your spouse doesn't show up in 48 hours, they get a search warrant. They come into your house. They get a search warrant. They get your computer. And by the way, the first thing to do is they'll get your Google searches. But for some reason, we've decided that the phone is sacred. So for some reason, if someone gets thrown into a trunk, if someone got thrown into a Lincoln Navigator trunk, and we were thought, okay, we'd like to see if there's an individual in the trunk and they got a search warrant. What if Ford said, you know, we're taking a stand for privacy and the car is sacred and we've created technology where you can't get into anyone's trunk? How would we feel about that? I don't see the difference here. So I'd like to think that our courts and our FBI, I stand with them over Apple, but Apple has taken this, some people would argue, principled stand for privacy. And the public supports it. What if the terrorists had had a BlackBerry and RIM had rejected the court order? I think we would have immediately on the floor of the Congress the next day passed legislation to close the border or have tariffs on Canadian products. I don't think we would have accepted RIM out of Waterloo, Canada, saying we're taking a stand against privacy and the terrorists that just killed 17 Americans, we're not going to open his phone. But with Apple, it's a different ballgame. And I think it reflects this, again, this transfer of confidence and belief from our traditional institutions to these for-profit institutions, failing to recognize they are there not to comfort us in our old age. They are not concerned with the condition of our souls. They are there to make more money, full stop. And we have to be cognizant of that.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking with Scott Galloway about his book, The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. So if Steve Jobs is the new Jesus Christ, who's the new God?
It's the consumer, hands down. If you loosely bucket our society into three types, workers, investors, and consumers, we've put the worker last. Uber drivers make $12.25 an hour. A new employee on the shop floor at General Motors in the 70s made $25 an hour. That's before inflation. We have investors, a lot of investor rights. There's always a tension between capital and labor. Capital has been kicking the crap out of labor for the last 30 years. There's a huge focus on returning as much money to shareholders as possible, even at the expense of employees. It used to be companies were more paternal and put employees kind of on the same level as investors. But there's just no doubt about it. If you're in a boardroom and there's an opportunity to eliminate jobs and increase earnings, you eliminate the jobs. So we've sort of shifted priorities. And then more than anything, the consumer reigns supreme. We don't conduct antitrust against these companies as long as they're good for the consumer. Go to another society, just see the kind of service you get. You get so spoiled in the U.S. The U.S. has this mentality where you can be a bad person, you can make no money, but if you show up to a restaurant or a hotel and you have the money and you're the consumer, people will defer to you, pretend to like you, be fascinated, make small talk with you, and you can call them on the phone from your room and say, I don't like my room, and they'll try and change it for you. We have decided that the consumer really is God.
But I think in your book, didn't you attribute that to Google?
Oh, thank you for the setup there. Yeah, so from a technology standpoint and an instinct standpoint, I think Google is kind of our new God in the sense that we used to pray to a being hoping for an answer back. Now we pray to Google. We ask these very complicated questions. Supposedly 20% of the queries to Google have never been asked before in the history of mankind. So what other source has so much credibility that one in five questions being presented to that individual have never been asked before? So put your name and your face above everything you've typed into Google, and you're going to find that you trust Google more than any other priest, rabbi, mentor, boss, coach. Google knows when you're about to get engaged. Google knows when you're thinking of getting divorced. Google knows all your ailments. Google knows who you're stalking from your past, what your sexual fetishes are. When you speak to your therapist, your spouse, your boss, it's mostly you, but it's also your representative, and that is the individual you present thinking that that person wants to hear. Google really does see the real you and sees everything. So again, in a society where we've become less reliant on a super being or church attendance, Google has filled that void. And is really the answer to our prayers, because what is a prayer? A query into the universe, hoping there's some sort of divine intervention. Will my kid be all right is a prayer I think anyone with children has uttered. And now it's symptoms and treatment of croup typed into the Google dialogue box. So thank you. Yes, I do think Google is, if you will, our modern man's God.
So when it comes to using Google, I get what you're saying about how much it knows about us, but I'm comforted to some extent by the fact that unless somebody's looking over my shoulder at my computer screen, I'm not having to share it with family and friends. It's my information, and yeah, somebody out there who I don't know knows a lot about me, and it might not even be a human, which is even better in one sense. But now move to Facebook, the only one of the four that I do not have any use for, and it's just simply because I consider it so damned intrusive that I wouldn't go near it. But I wanted to have you talk about it, its value proposition, just what its value is today and what kind of information it collects.
Facebook is, I do think it taps into this instinct for love. I do think that Facebook with WhatsApp, with Messenger and Instagram now and the core platform is the connective tissue between a lot of people, helping them keep updated with each other, even if it's just sharing photos. And imagery is so powerful. It creates greater empathy, greater connections, catalyzes and reinforces the most important and less important relationships in our lives. So I do think Facebook taps into this instinct to not only need to be loved, but to love others. And the usage is just staggering. In addition, because people are publicly on display, the amount of data, and this is their advantage over Google, people are publicly saying, this is where I am. So Facebook can then target them pretty overtly, and it's less offensive or less frightening because they've said openly to their 800 friends, I'm at this hotel in Chicago with these people. And then when you layer on top the technology and the targeting, traditionally media vehicles have been able to offer you half a billion people in the Super Bowl, 99% of whom are not in the market for a South Korean car. So it's going to be irrelevant, but we'll still get 50,000 people. So it's worth it. Or 500,000 people if it's 1% of a half a billion. Or we're going to bring 12 neurosurgeons together for an expensive dinner and it costs $500 a person, but we're going to talk to them about a drug and it's relevant to everyone in the room. Facebook is really the first platform that can offer that sort of scale, 2.2 billion people on the platform with that sort of target. We've never been able to, they can literally target households with teens who just got their driver's license that are upper income in Short Hills, New Jersey. And there's enough of them because basically everybody's on Facebook that it's worthwhile for the marketer. So that peanut butter and chocolate combination of scale and targeting ability is just unprecedented. And so as a result, they have 5 million advertisers. And even when there's evidence that they didn't put in place the safeguards to ensure that our democracy wasn't undermined or subterfuged, 7 of the 5 million advertisers announced they're leaving Facebook, not because these people aren't patriotic, but because they have no choice. So, you know, Facebook is a staggeringly powerful platform. Now, whether or not people like you and me are abandoning Facebook or not on it as much, I agree with you. I don't find that much use in it. But if you look at the metrics around Instagram, if you look at the metrics around WhatsApp, you know, the company continues to grow. And at least in the short term, it looks as if its business is going to only continue to accelerate.
So would you just comment for our last question, and then we really run out of time. Zuckerberg, the huge data breach, his testimony before Congress, how do you think that worked?
I think Mark Zuckerberg is the most dangerous person on the planet. And not because he's a bad person, but I think, again, power corrupts. And if you buy into the American way, you buy into the notion of checks and balances. We'll have to endure Trump for a maximum of 6 years. Putin will be dead in 10 to 20 years. With Mark Zuckerberg, you have someone who oversees the algorithms to decide what content 2 billion people see every day. And that has enormous power and influence. If Facebook were to go down for an hour, about a half a billion people would know about it. If all of a sudden Facebook were to deliberately start in a very elegant way promoting certain themes or certain ideological principles or certain political leanings, it's incredibly powerful and influential. And we have one individual who has total control. There's two classes of stock. He'll be with us for at least 70 years. So everyone was freaked out when Castro took over the island nation of Cuba, 11 million people at the age of 33. Mark Zuckerberg is 33 and oversees a population more vast than Christianity and can't be removed from office and will be with us for 70 years. You know, what could go wrong? So I think it's a terrible lapse in oversight to let an individual amass that kind of power with no ability to remove that person from office. So, I think it's a dangerous situation and a situation that we need to ensure doesn't happen again. To give you some insight into Mark Zuckerberg's thinking, last year he proposed a third class of stock where he could sell his entire economic stake, every share in the company, and still control the company. And so the argument I make is that if you oversee a flock of 2 billion people and you want to set up a situation where you no longer work there, invest in the flock, have any risk or economic stake in the flock, but still control what the flock believes and sees, haven't you in effect decided that you are in fact Jesus Christ? And in the midst of all this controversy around Cambridge Analytica, Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook decided to launch Messenger Kids, which is effectively a gateway drug, a social media platform for children. You know, my kids are more well-balanced because of social media, said no parent ever. I think Mark Zuckerberg is a genius, a visionary, and also a college dropout that screwed over his good friends in college and really screwed over his best friend outside of college and now believes he should oversee a flock of 2 billion people with no checks and balances. I think he's the most dangerous person on the planet.
Scott, all I can say is keep writing. Keep focused on this issue. Your book, The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, I cannot recommend this book more strongly. We haven't touched the surface, but I want to thank you for writing it. And most importantly, like I said, write on. Thank you so much for being with us today at Reader's Corner.
Oh, thanks, brother. Let's keep fighting the good fight.
Absolutely. I hope you enjoyed this encore interview with Scott Galloway. Next week, David Gran, author of The White Darkness, and an upcoming speaker at the Cabin's Readings and Conversations series. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. If you missed some of our recent shows, including last week's interview, you can find them on our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. You can also sign up for our free podcast email on the website and download our free app for mobile devices to listen anytime, anywhere.